Okay, so I'm sort of an outlier in this meeting, at least according to what I've seen so far, in the sense that I don't work on star formation per se. How do we form single stars? But I am very interested in how stars form and how their effects cascade onto galactic scales in the early universe. So I'm going to tell you some about my recent work to understand the properties of star formation, or the outcome of star formation, in the very earliest phases of the formation of the Milky Way and other galaxies at high redshift during the so-called Dark Ages. When I give my more PR-oriented talks, I like to put my motivations into the... This thing is kind of silly. Okay. Is this thing working at all? All right, never mind. I won't be using the pointer. I like to put my motivations in the 200-point font. Now, when I first started out doing this and first started giving talks about this topic, people looked at me and sometimes would even ask me outright, isn't this sort of crazy? Isn't it premature to try to understand the mass function of early stars in the formation of the Milky Way or other galaxies? Because they all, you know, all this action wrapped up so long ago, they're gone. You know, we won't see them until we get telescopes that can look to redshift 20. I actually disagree with that now, and I disagree with it even more. I disagreed with that then, and I disagree with it even more now. Because so much of the astrophysics comes out of the IMF, so much information gets locked into other observables about the galaxies and the stars. Everything comes out of it, and I think there are ways to walk back along these pathways that we can learn to use. We're just now learning to use these things. Good. Now I figured it out. So, as it turns out, by studying a dark matter-only assembly history for the Milky Way, we can actually ask how many little pieces did the Milky Way exist in at these epochs. And this gives us some idea of how, what portion of the galaxy mass function we're leveraging, how much leverage we do have on early times. Is there a problem, Chris? So at redshifts of 10-ish, the Milky Way was in several dozen, maybe a couple of hundred little pieces. And I think it's going to be very difficult, if not impossible, to learn the things we want to learn about the stellar mass function, especially at the low mass end, by studying these things directly in the high redshift universe. I'm not saying that's completely impossible. I'm just saying it's a challenge, and at the very least, we would like to have some sort of complementary form of information about these things. Fortunately, indicators of this era exist, and they come in the form of low-mass stars that formed during these early epochs that live a Hubble time or more and are still around today in the halo of the Milky Way. Now, the reason we can use these things is that... Let me do this one before I do that one. The reason we can use these things is that observers have gone to all the trouble over a period of 10 or 20 years to collect large samples of extremely metal-poor stars that reside in the galactic halo, generally kinematically or chemically selected. Then they've taken enormous pains with 8-meter telescopes and very efficient spectrographs working over wide ranges of wavelength to find abundance patterns in all sorts of elements over a wide range of metallicity. This is just one example. This is a single study by Barkham et al. Using the so-called Hamburg-ESO survey of metal-poor stars. The important thing is that we have a range of metallicities. So this is a 10^-1.5 solar iron abundance. This goes all the way to 1/10,000th the solar iron abundance. And the most important thing is that we get elements across the periodic table from carbon, magnesium, titanium, calcium, other alpha chain elements, things in the iron peak like chromium, manganese, cobalt, nickel, and zinc, and critically, neutron capture elements that are created sometimes in supernovae, sometimes in AGB stars, things like strontium, yttrium, zirconium, barium, europium, rare things you never think about. They're now, this is 250 stars covering 15 or so elements in this sample. They're now, tens of thousands of stars known below 10^-2, below 1% solar metallicity, with an enormous amount of information known. You probably can't see this red text down here at the bottom, but this is actually something like only a few percent of the way through the full sample that will exist at the end of the 10-year period. There are samples, surveys like Sloan Segway, plus it's which is focusing on the HALO. The Sloan survey also plans an extension called Apogee, which is supposed to go and focus mainly on the bulge and the disk in the inner regions. There's things like the DART survey from ESO, RAVE, LIMOST in China, WIFMOS may get going on Gemini. So this is there's really an explosion in the data samples. Now, I don't do any of this kind of stuff myself. I just, you know, take the outcome of the observations and try to interpret them in theoretical models. But I'm very grateful that this is now possible because it enables basically everything I'm trying to do. The important thing about this is that we get elements from all the nucleosynthetic processes, the important ones that we know about. This is relevant because it is these different nucleosynthetic processes that map to different regions of the IMF, that map to different mass ranges. Now, I'm not going to try to tell you I know how many 10 solar mass stars there are in an early IMF compared to 11 solar mass stars, but I think we can weigh these different mass ranges against one another and say whether there's a skew relative to the normal universal, so-called universal IMF we all know about. So the important processes really are the CNO burning, processes that occur in low and intermediate mass stars and which become very peculiar and very noticeable when they occur in the late stages of evolution, like the AGB phase. This mass range also gives us this so-called slow neutron capture nucleosynthesis. Very peculiar elements, things like barium and yttrium that we now know how to detect. The signature of the massive stars is, of course, the alpha elements, the iron peak elements that occur in explosive nucleosynthesis when these things blow up at the end of their lives. And they're also believed to be the progenitors of the so-called R process, the rapid neutron capture process, elements like europium and lanthanum, which are very clear-cut also in the stellar abundance patterns. And so by using these processes and studying their evolution with metallicity and comparing the frequency of these different elements and their abundances as a function of metallicity in the population, we can hope to learn something about the mass function thanks to this fundamental feature of stellar nucleosynthesis. Now, in some of my talks, I go ahead and talk about the very massive stars and their peculiar yields and try to convince you that those yields are absent from all of the abundance patterns that we see. Other than what I just said, I'm not going to speak about those things because I'm concerned with a different generation other than the first. So maybe you notice in my title this peculiar abbreviation, CEMP. That's what I'm really here to tell you about, the carbon-enhanced metal poor stars. Now, those are important for a whole host of reasons, but most importantly because I think they tell us something about the mass function of stars in the range of, say, 1/10,000th to 1/100th the solar metal abundance. What are these things? Well, they're a fairly new discovery in stellar abundance studies, because they're most prominent below around 1% solar, and it's only in the last, say, 5 years that samples below this metallicity have become large enough for these objects to be statistically significant. Now, the definition of a CEMP, carbon-enhanced metal poor star, is that its ratio of carbon to iron needs to exceed the solar value by a factor of 10 or more. This is fairly arbitrary, but it has to be imposed for definitional purposes. Nick?
Why are you calling them carbon-enhanced metal poor star rather than iron-deficient intermediate intensity star?
In the end, it doesn't matter unless you have a physical mechanism that favors the origin of the carbon over the deficit of the iron as the important thing. And I will try to convince you that's the case. Okay. By the way, there doesn't seem to be a selection mechanism that favors stars that have the carbon enhancement over stars that don't have the carbon enhancement. In other words, they're selected with iron and calcium, and so there's no strong selection bias in favor of these things. Now, the interesting thing about these CEMPs is that they become increasingly frequent in the population as you go to lower and lower metal abundances. Below 10 to the minus 1 in the HALO, they're only 10%. As you go down, 20% below minus 2, 40% below minus 3.5, and all of the stars we know about at minus 4.5 or below, of which there are now 3, show this phenomenon. The two most famous examples are the so-called Frabel star, HE1327, and the so-called Christlieb star. This one was actually discovered first in 2002, HE0107. Now, you don't need to know the phone numbers. I'll just call them by Norbert and Anna's names.
Where is she?
Oh, the third one is sitting right at minus 4.5 or 4.6. There's a very recent paper by John Norris and the permutation of the same authors. They're probably going to keep cranking these out one every 6 months or so because they have a huge area of sky covered and it just takes time to analyze them. But in any case, these things become more and more common as you go to lower and lower metallicities. And then the question of their origin becomes fairly acute. Now, one interpretation is that the carbon enhancement exists throughout the entire mass of the star, and that has some implications for their origins. I'm going to tell you that isn't so, and the argument for that is pretty sound, I think, at this point. So I'll go through that over the period of a couple slides. The favored interpretation, the interpretation that's consistent with most of the data, basically all of it, in fact, and has yet to have any strong evidence against it, is that these stars are born as the low-mass partner in a close binary system, and that the carbon they have exists only at their surfaces in the outer convective zones and is acquired by mass transfer from an intermediate mass companion that has gone through an AGB phase and had matter accreted, then transferred to the low-mass partner. The best evidence for this is that 80% of all of these CEMP stars fall into yet another subclass, the CEMPS stars, that show S process enhancement detected in barium, very clear-cut detections. 80% of these things show what we consider to be the smoking gun signature of accretion from an AGB companion. The other 20% are a little ambiguous. There is actually a mass range of AGB stars where it's possible the S elements either don't get produced or don't get mixed up into the matter that's transferred. And so the other 20% are at least consistent with this picture, and in no case would rule it out.
So why this process does it work on high metallicity system?
In fact, this process does occur in higher metallicity systems. It's just harder to see it.
Where are they?
They're here. And they fall below this arbitrary definition. You know, only a certain mass gets transferred, and as the metallicity goes up, it's lost. It's lost in the in the background metallicity that the star had initially.
But presumably, if it's a binary system, both stars have the same metallicity.
Yeah, but it's just the carbon that this is primary carbon, so the production relative to what's already there is minor. Okay. So the other observational fact is that when they go to measure radial velocity variations in these CEMPS stars, they're consistent with 100% binary fraction. Sorry.
Sorry,
yeah.
So this carbon which is being transferred is a carbon that's actually produced in the intermediate.
Yeah, but it's small compared to what's already there in a normal metallicity star.
I understand, but the metallicity is a large fraction. But it's probably the transfer. So it would have to be diffused over the center, over the surface.
Yeah. Well, now there's shell burning as well. What are you asking me?
I'm asking you, I just don't know that that's a carbon that's going on.
Yeah, this process can occur with starting with absolutely zero metallicity. Yeah.
Why isn't it also oxygen rich?
In many cases it is.
Oh.
Yeah. I'll show you an abundance pattern that's oxygen rich. So when they go measure radial velocity variations, you can ask, given the baseline I've waited for, how many cases should I have seen a binary or seen radial velocity variations in for a given binary fraction? And the answer is 100%. It's consistent with 100% binarity. So radial velocities, nucleosynthesis, all favors this binary scenario. Now,
did it also imply that all the stars of that mass were binaries? Is that a ratio?
It doesn't necessarily, but I'll go through that in a moment.
Yeah, that question is mine.
Yeah, right. Yeah, that's in fact what's implied. So this interpretation is very sound for the 80% of stars that are CEMPS or S process enriched, because that's the clear signature in AGB. It's a little bit less clear in these cases because this one has no detection of S elements. This one has a limit on one. It has a detection of strontium in this, which is perfectly consistent with this scenario. But for those two stars, at least, you have to go through a little more argument to make the case. And in fact, this case applies equally well. This argument applies equally well to all of the CEMP stars. So I actually went through this in some detail because I kept going to meetings where these things were discussed, and I kept walking away not knowing any more than I did when I started. And so I had to go through all of these papers which proposed origins for these two abundance patterns, these two peculiar stars, and ask which is actually, you know, which actually work and which don't. So the data is here. You can see this is a carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, C, N, and O. You can see that these two stars are enhanced above a factor of 1,000 in all of C, N, and O. So there's enhancement with all of the elements that you expect from the...
What are the multiple bounds?
Oh, it depends on whether you how you do the model atmosphere, whether it's LTE or non-LTE or 1D or 3D or whatever. It's a detail for fans of stellar atmosphere modeling. So one of the most appealing models, at least on the basis of its ability to fit the data, is from the Tokyo group around Ken Nemoto. The first author of this particular paper is Iwamoto. It was in Science a couple years ago. And they have this great supernova model with many, many knobs on it, and you can tune it to do whatever you want. And so by making faint supernovae, in other words, supernovae that explode with less than 10 to the 51 ergs per event, they were able to eject all of the lighter elements in the onion skin model of the supernova, the carbon, eject most of the carbon, and keep most of the iron in the remnant. So they got yields that were extremely rich in C, N, and O, and extremely poor in iron, essentially. And so they got this abundance pattern quite nicely. Well, a similar model, similar in spirit anyway, is to suggest that massive stars that exist in the early universe are rotating very rapidly. They kick a lot of material off in the winds. Carbon that gets produced in the interior gets mixed up to the surface and kicked off in the wind. And these low mass stars form in the material that's kicked off from a nearby massive star. Colin looks like he's going to ask a question.
It's very interesting what you're saying, so I'm leaning forward.
Okay, sorry. Both of these two scenarios, which involve the carbon ejected sort of preferentially from a massive star, C N and O ejected preferentially from a massive star, both of them, in fact, require, must have this be true, require dilution into a large reservoir of fresh gas. Right? These are metal-free stars that have been posited because we want to end up with a star at 10 to the minus 5 solar metallicity. In order for this to work, in fact, they could calculate in the context of their model, basically to machine precision, exactly what the ejective carbon was. And that tells you exactly that it needs 860 solar masses of fresh gas to dilute these ejecta to get this abundance pattern, the absolute amount of iron, the absolute amount of carbon. Same here, 10 to the 4, 10 to the 5 solar mass. The problem with this, and the reason those models simply don't work and the entire class of models don't work, is that at least in one of these cases, HE1327, where the star is a subgiant, hasn't come off completely off the main sequence yet, there's a very strong upper limit on the lithium abundance. Now, this star could not have destroyed its own lithium based on our understanding of lithium depletion and its present evolutionary state. So the lithium must have been depleted in some other fashion. If you take supernova ejecta, deplete all the lithium, say, in a 25 solar mass star like this, and then dilute that 25 solar masses of completely lithium-depleted material into 1,000 solar masses of fresh primordial gas, the lithium abundance should recover basically all the way back to the primordial value, or within 1 over the dilution mass of that value.
What do you assume for the primordial value?
It almost doesn't matter what you assume because the limit is so strong. They find epsilon lithium of less than 1, where BBN is this, and the so-called speed plateau for metal-poor stars is this. So it's a factor of more than 10 depleted from...
What is epsilon?
Epsilon is in those funny log 12...
Units. At the log value.
Yeah. You know, by number, it's 10 to the 12 minus this value. Okay. So lithium is far too depleted for this to be the signature of depletion and then dilution into a large reservoir of gas. So in my view, this strong limit on lithium rules out any model where that level of dilution has to occur. In fact, when you just take this limit on lithium and you ask, given a total mass of lithium depleted material, what can the dilution mass be and still recover this limit? The answer is something like 0.01 to 0.1 solar masses. That is of order the mass that can be transferred from an AGB star to a low mass companion in a close binary. So actually it hangs together extremely well. This the lithium, in my view, rules out effectively the faint supernova in the stellar winds model and anything that requires high levels of dilution. This to me indicates that at least this one, where the lithium detection is possible, has the same origin as the rest of the CEMP stars, a close binary system. This one is a giant star, so the lithium limit is meaningless. It would have depleted its own. Okay, so how does this have anything to do with the IMF, you're asking me, no doubt. The answer is that if you can measure in a population the frequency of stars that went through an AGB phase through this nucleosynthetic signature, and measure just by going out and counting them the number of stars at a given metallicity that have a low mass, low enough mass to still be around today, you have leverage on the IMF in the range of just a little bit less than one and then around 3 to 5 solar masses. And turns out this works. Okay, so the basic scenario I think you probably already grasped. CNO-rich material is transferred to the low mass companion. But we're counting these by counting the number of CEMP stars there are. And we're counting these by just counting all metal poor stars. Okay, so the ratio of carbon-rich to carbon-normal stars at any metallicity measures the ratio of intermediate mass to low mass stars at that metallicity. Now here are some actual numbers. By counting these in the very early days when the samples were pretty small...
Sorry. It's 1.0, right? Because you still have the metal poor stars.
Well, yes. I mean, this is qualitative. That's right. You're right. Yeah. You have to count the ones... You have to count everything, right, in the denominator.
This is a single stellar population, no binaries, that statement.
No, well, there have to be binaries.
Well, that's what I'm trying to understand. It doesn't depend on the binary.
No, this is not an equation. This is just a qualitative statement that maybe I should say, I'm not sure what I should say.
Yeah, okay.
So one estimate obtained in the very early days of counting these objects was that the characteristic mass of a log normal IMF needed to be greater than 0.8 solar masses, which is still above where we think it is in the solar neighborhood. By asking what the two hypermetal poor stars mean in comparison with the complete absence of any carbon normal hypermetal poor stars, remember, I think that these things could form. There's no reason they couldn't. And we're seeing two low mass stars that originated in binaries with intermediate mass stars and none that didn't. You can use that to set a limit on the characteristic mass of somewhere between 1.5 and 6, depending on how you set the mass ranges for the AGB phenomenon. I did this one. And then there's a paper by a Japanese group that's responsible for the original binary mass transfer model for HE0107 that got something like 10 solar masses to get all of the abundance patterns right, or rather not only the number of CEMP stars, but also the number of CEMPS stars and the number of stars that don't show the S process enrichment. So they get 10 solar masses.
But how did they get 10? Because the 10 solar mass stars presumably would have exploded with the supernova.
That's right. So you're counting on you're actually using the fact that the IMF turns over again. So all this stuff disappears. Mm-hmm. And you're using the fact that there are more of these up here closer to 8 than there are down here closer to 1.5. The reason that works is that if you want a certain number of stars that are carbon enhanced but don't show S, you have to use this mass range here of 5 to 8 where at least some models indicate the low metallicity stars go through an AGB phase but don't kick off the S elements. So I think you probably grasp the connection between the IMF. Everybody here is a smart cookie, so I don't need to go through this one. This is a summary of these results as a function of metallicity, and together with my earlier claims about the IMF of metal-free stars, where I think it settles somewhere between 8-ish and 50-ish solar masses.
Sorry, Jason.
Yeah.
What is MC?
This is the characteristic mass of a log normal IMF right here.
Oh, log normal.
Yeah. So these are indications, and in fact all these are formal lower limits, of a characteristic mass of a log normal IMF of one solar mass or above at a range of at a metallicity of say a little less than 10 to the minus 5 to around 10 to the minus 3. Now, if you're familiar with the literature on this subject, you're probably, I won't presume that you are, so I'll say that if you ask how many metals do you need for the cooling and fragmentation to occur efficiently and not form the, you know, H2-driven stars that Tom gets in his simulations, but fragment down to lower masses, that critical metallicity is somewhere in the range of 10 to the minus 5 to 10 to the minus 3 solar iron abundance, depending on whether, you know, depending on how you treat the dust cooling, which turns out to be a highly uncertain industry in the early universe. So why would the IMF favor intermediate mass stars, even for populations that seem to be at or above this critical metallicity? My proposed explanation is that these stars form under the thermal influence of the cosmic microwave background at high redshift. And so it doesn't matter what their metallicity is. They cannot escape the CMB. And in fact, my view is that the CMB, in fact, moderates this transition, at least over some range of redshift, moderates this transition from massive to low mass stars. Now, what I want to show you is two lines of evidence that the CMB is the factor and nothing else. Now, if you really, really press me, I'll say, of course, I don't know if it's the CMB or not, but I do have two pieces of evidence that indicate that it's something that's redshift dependent. Okay? So this is a very, very crude theory of star formation. It has nothing to do with turbulence or anything. It just tells you, you just presume that you know what the characteristic mass is as a function of temperature. Right? That's why theory is in quotes. Any details we can talk about later. First prediction of the so-called CMB-IMF hypothesis is that just from the way chemical evolution develops, where the lowest metallicities tend to occur earlier and higher metallicities tend to occur later, on average, more metal-poor stars form earlier and so should show a higher ratio of these CEMP stars in more metal-poor populations. So it should be evolution with metallicity in this phenomenon. Prediction number two is that star, and this is sort of the flip side of this one, is that star formation at the same metallicity can occur at different times, right? This is the stochastic sort of non-local behavior in chemical evolution. And the inside-out construction of dark matter halos, where the inner stuff forms earliest, means that the inner stuff is older, saw a hotter CMB, and so has a higher characteristic mass, and so has a higher fraction of carbon-enhanced metal-poor stars. This suggests a spatial gradient from older regions of the galaxy, older metal-poor stellar populations, to younger metal-poor stellar populations at the same metallicity. This is really the key indicator that it's a redshift-dependent thing, perhaps the CMB, and not just a metallicity-dependent thing. You want to see a spatial gradient at some metallicity.
Which region of the galaxy is young and which ones?
I'll show you. I mean, you have to be careful about how you choose those things. So all of this is done in the context of my semi-analytic and now numerically based merger tree models for the assembly history of the Milky Way. This is what allows me to follow the non-local behavior of chemical evolution. In other words, there are bound objects over here and bound objects over here, and there's some prescription for having them communicate with one another, but you can follow the fact that the Milky Way doesn't develop in a homogeneous cube like, you know, classical chemical evolution. It in fact has a merger tree history. So when you fold all this in and you add the redshift dependent IMF driven by the CMB, here's what you get. This is something like a million individual parcels of star formation that occur through that whole merger tree history over time. This is their metallicity, and this is the characteristic mass they had given the redshift at which they formed and that extremely crude theory of star formation. You'll notice that all the really metal-poor stars below minus 2.5 or minus 3 or so form at a fairly high redshift, generally above redshift 4, and so they see a relatively warm CMB. Stars at around minus 2 or so form over a very wide range of epochs, all the way from the very earliest times, you know, right after the first generation, all the way down to redshift 1 or so. That's the reason that occurs where it does is that the model is sort of generally set up to reproduce the mass metallicity relation of surviving dwarf galaxies, which all come in at around minus 2. Okay. And then above that, you know, higher metallicity corresponds to later times. When you fold all of this in with your stellar population model, your model of binarity, and you ask, does this model effectively predict or reproduce the evolution of the observed properties of the CEMP stars, you find that in fact it does. So this is the fraction of stars in a population that are carbon enhanced as a function of their metallicity. The data points are all in these filled symbols. Minus 2, it's something like 20%. Minus 3, it's something like 30 to 40%. And it goes basically to 100 with a huge error bar since there are only 2 at the minus 5.5 point. This model here, sort of a fiducial stochastic Milky Way halo building model, is the gray region there. So at minus 1, you go from, you know, hardly any of these in the population, to minus 2, about 20%, and on up to 40%. So the evolution with metallicity is reproduced because the more metal-poor stars form earlier, see a hotter CMB, and see a higher characteristic mass. So that's signature one of a redshift-dependent IMF driven by the CMB.
So can you point out in your model where the bars
are? Well, this is halo only. In
which part of the cloud would you tell me is the halo
bars? Well, this model doesn't have a bulge in it. It just has a halo.
Yeah.
Okay. Right. Right. Okay. So the bulge is going to be in here because the, you know, the metallicity of the bulge is fairly high, right?
Yeah. But the bulge is the first thing that forms, right? Okay.
Right. Well, so the bulge, I think it's kind of ambiguous to talk about that because instead of talking about bulge, you should talk about inner halo. Right, the inner parts of the halo are different from what we think of as the bulge. Because when you ask an observer about the bulge, they tell you about the more metal-rich spheroidal.
Yeah. Doesn't matter, right? If you forget all the dynamics, let's call it the inner halo.
Yeah.
If your cloud is going to be composed from a star fairly young, right?
No, the inner halo is going to the inner halo, which is spatially coincident with the bulge, is all in here. Metal poor stuff that formed very early.
So where are the metal rich stars that we see in the bulge?
The metal rich stars that we see in the bulge come from later, during bulge formation. This is the difference between bulge and inner halo. Yeah. The bulge probably dates from a much later epoch when things funnel in quickly and go boom. Maybe even redshift 2 or 3. Right. This is the inner halo. To say that the inner halo is in the bulge is probably true, but it doesn't mean they're the same thing. Okay. Right. So, getting on to prediction two. Why do I think this is true? Well, I'll show you a little movie, if I can get my mouse. The red particles are the particles that are in virialized objects at redshift 10. Right? So we'll watch that go, if it runs. Right. So we go from redshift 25. We form little dark matter halos that I showed initially here, 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 and here. Okay, little pieces. Now we want to ask, where are these things at redshift 0? So we're going to take the same particles, tag them the same way with the red dots, and we find that in the final large halo, all of the red particles, all the particles that were in little virialized galaxies at redshift 10, are concentrated in the very center. This is the gist of your question, I think. That the oldest stuff is centrally concentrated. I think you're right.
So that's not actually true.
It is.
Most
it is.
Of them would not all.
Well, I didn't say all, did I?
Well,
I mean, I say centrally concentrated. I don't mean there's a sharp edge to it. Just that if you add, you know, where if you plot a density distribution of the stuff that's virialized at redshift 10, it's more centrally condensed than the particles that virialize at redshift 3.
Yeah, but the fraction of those. So what kind of simulation is this?
It's
the fraction of those are survivors.
What?
A fraction of those would be...
A fraction of those are survivors, yeah. It doesn't. It happens that... In fact, there's one. Yeah. You're right.
So it's about 20% fractions.
You're right.
20% of the stuff.
Well, and there's one here. There's one there.
Okay.
I mean, this is a low-resolution screen, but yeah, there are survivors.
Okay.
That's right. Yeah. Okay, so this age gradient at single metallicity gives you a gradient in this... chemical signature of the IMF with galactocentric radius. The stuff that ends up in the inner halo tended to form earlier at any metallicity that you pick. So pick a constant metallicity. The stuff that's inside the halo, very deep in the halo, will tend to have formed earlier. That's the evolution of characteristic mass in the gray with galactocentric radius. It could be quite high for stars that formed in the inner halo. This translates directly into a gradient in this quantity, the frequency of these CEMP stars, the IMF-linked chemical signature with galactocentric radius. Now, this is a test. This particular test has not been done. Right? So this is an indicator of an influence on the IMF that is not just the metallicity, right? It's decoupled from the metallicity.
Jason, can you explain again? I see the fairly steep gradient in the gray, and then when you convert it into the observed thing, it looks like it's almost
flat. It's because of I think that's because of the way the averaging is done, and also this population that formed a very high characteristic mass is leaving essentially no low mass stars behind, effectively very few. And so most of the average in this curve comes from the lower masses.
It's actually flat, right? So it's very difficult to use it as a factor.
Well, okay, so it's a factor of about 2 from inner to outer. Maybe this is hard.
But the dispersion is bigger than that.
I don't know how big the dispersion is going to be, but
what is hedged?
Right. So that depends on which theory of star formation you adopt, whether it's the higher power law with temperature or the lower power law with temperature. But you're on either one of these and not both, probably. You know, you're not going to go from here to here. Okay. So this is one possible signature. Another one is actually pretty exciting and may already have been seen, in fact. That means that this is formally not a prediction, I suppose. But if you take the same sample of stars, Hamburg-Itso survey stars, where they measure the carbon enhancement, and they try to estimate the height above the midplane, the galactic midplane for these things, in other words, whether they're in the thick disk or whether they're in the halo, and they find a gradient. So at the midplane, the fraction of all stars below -2 that show the carbon enhancement is about 9%. But it increases, and I know these error bars are large, but if you average bins out here, it ends up being like a 2.5 sigma result, which is why I'm not betting the farm on it yet. But it does look like there's a gradient from the younger thick disk of the Milky Way to the older halo of the Milky Way. Now, this, just in terms of data alone, is an indication that this phenomenon responds to something other than metallicity. It somehow knows what orbits these stars are on, which somehow knows about where and when they were born, right? So this is a decoupling from a pure metallicity effect, which means you can't explain this phenomenon just solely in terms of stars of certain metallicities knowing how to make this process and others not knowing how. There has to be something else going on.
Why is it 2.5 sigma? You have 9.
Well, if you bend this up, it ends up being off this line by a couple sigma.
But it's 9 points more than 1 sigma away, so it's at least 3 sigma.
Okay. Good. I've forgotten this number.
Like 4.
Yeah. So, but here it's not quite so good, right? So this is below -3, but it's approaching the level of serious significance. The reason I haven't sweated this too much is that this is just a test sample for the larger Sloan Segway sample that'll be coming out probably in the next year or so, where they're going to do this for real. They'll have realistic orbits. They'll be able to say whether something's really in the halo or really in the thick disk. And we'll be able to do, once I get my full n-body-based merger tree models going, we'll be able to do fully kinematic and chemical studies coupling both of these signatures together and trying to unravel them completely. So just to advertise for the surveys, this is a big industry now. This is going on in Australia, the Siding Spring Stellar Survey. My favorite one is Sloan Segway, which is operating from Apache Point, a place I know and love. Sloan is going to follow Segway with Apogee, which is focused on the bulge, the inner halo, which they don't usually put in there, and the disk. And it's working in the infrared, so it actually makes it possible and, in fact, easy in many ways. This is an artist's conception of the Chinese project LAMOST, which is one of the big initiatives of Chinese astronomy in the next few years. There's even more ridiculous things people are talking about, a billion metallicities in kinematic measurements from ESA's Gaia mission, and the mythical WIFMOS, which has been through many travails over the last few years but may eventually end up on Gemini or Subaru, could do this with a million high-resolution spectra. So going from, you know, tens of points like I've had on my plots to millions with full kinematics and really doing this right. I just want to advertise for my colleague Peter Van Dockham, who has found similar results in color and luminosity evolution of passively evolving massive cluster galaxies. Peter argues that you can't get the color evolution and the luminosity, your mass-to-light ratio evolution, of these very massive cluster galaxies right unless they had a fairly flat IMF around one solar mass compared to an IMF that's steeply increasing below a solar mass. If this is true, then I think it's broadly concordant with what I'm saying about the IMF from galactic stars. And Peter's even made a helpful summary plot for me with redshift on the bottom here and characteristic mass on the y-axis. This is the plot that people would have thought was crazy a few years ago. We have the Milky Way disk down here at around a tenth to three-tenths of a solar mass. Peter finds these cluster galaxies imply something like a characteristic mass of two or so solar masses at their formation epoch, which is redshifts of 2 to 6. And if I plot the region implied by my CEMPs plus my CMB hypothesis, it's basically in this red rectangle. And so higher characteristic mass at higher redshift, and this would probably extend over this way, is implied and broadly concordant with other claims about the high redshift universe.
Yes, to add to the record, a historical point is that the people that have been doing chemical evolution have said this for 20 years now.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean,
this is not very new from that point of view.
It's new in the sense of well, but they weren't basing it on the color versus luminosity evolution. They were basing it on okay. So I mean, maybe from my background, I'm even more inclined to believe that. But okay, we'll have to talk about this more later. Yeah. Okay. So maybe you're familiar with the general phenomenon that I see a lot of, right? Which is, well, how do you know that's really the IMF changing? How do you know that's not, you know, some screwy isochrone or some uncertainty about chemical evolution or Yeah, well, isochrones don't save you in terms of the chemical elements, but it seems like somebody in the audience will always have some reason why it's uncertain. You know, your assumptions are uncertain or your models are uncertain for another reason, and you're really not learning anything about the IMF. This happens all the time. So one of my questions for discussion is in fact that, but before that, I wanted to assume that Colin's questions were to be useful and not just provocative, and I wanted to provide an answer for this one, or part of an answer for this one. This question is, what determines the transition at very early times from high-mass stars to low-mass stars? My answer, in part, is that it's CMB mediated. It's mediated by a larger feature of the environment, a feature which is ubiquitous, and it's not just metallicity. There have been a lot of theories, a lot of theoretical work trying to refine this range of metallicity, but I think, in part, they're misguided. I mean, the critical metallicity probably exists. It's probably a very useful concept, provided there's no CMB to keep you above a certain temperature. So, I think this is important. It actually indicates that you could have a top-heavy IMF at any metallicity. And this is why the critical metallicity criterion goes away.
That's almost certainly true near the center of the Milky Way.
Well, so there we have a problem.
That's actually the problem.
Yeah, so there we have a problem. You're right. The temperatures are probably higher, so there we have a problem. Let me skip ahead a little bit and come back to these. The IMF is essentially normal, even in relatively nearby regions, such as the galactic center, where naive treatments of the thermal physics, like those, like the one I've adopted to make this model, suggest it should be top-heavy, where the dust temperature is 40 Kelvin or something like that. And, right?
The Arches cluster is even higher.
Arches cluster is even a little bit higher. We would love to use this as, you know, nearby evidence that this phenomenon can even exist in the first place, but it doesn't appear to be true. Now,
the dust temperature is different from CMB. You cannot get away from CMB.
That's right.
The radiation environment in the Arches cluster is pretty hard to escape.
Yeah.
And the densities are certainly high enough that the dust and gas should be well linked. Right. I think that the non-variation of the IMF in the Arches cluster is a huge mystery.
Even in the very centers of the cores of the cores.
Yeah. Well, as Chris is fond of pointing out, if you're living surrounded by a black body field, you can't be colder than
that
the radiation
field.
Environment.
Yeah. So I'm glad to hear you at least regard this as a major problem. Right?
It's a huge problem.
It's a huge problem, right. So we all naively expect that the IMF should respond to its thermal environment. In fact, that's the argument that Richard Larson was making that I learned at his knee when I got to Yale and had now adopted into this line of argument. So there must be something else that's going on, something else that's relevant, at least in these local environments. But to me, that just makes the whole problem more interesting. Right? So actually, this is sort of the gist of my second question for discussion here. How do the thermal conditions interact with the properties of the turbulence, right? This was another one of yours as well, right? This is something that has to be worked out. If you guys gave me a fully predictive theory of the IMF, I would go out and test it, right? I don't have one, so I'm using this half-assed one.
You also have a prediction for the turbulence at higher altitude, which you don't have.
Yeah.
Unless you have discriminated resolution simulation.
Okay, so, right?
Can we find, what do you think of this, Tom? I mean, part one, do you think it really is mediated by the CMB?
Well, the interesting thing with this critical metallicity, I think, is already, even at zero metallicity, we're now finding that regions that form out of relegated two regions, meaning where you have UV heating before, that they actually make a little bit more H2, which is just enough to get you to HD cooling, which gets you to the CME.
Yeah.
So there's like this whole thing is just sort of borderline, but we're not quite sure now because the H2 cooling function is changing.
Yeah.
And we're not sure that's
true. Oh, I thought you didn't have any tunable knobs. Okay, so the point about the metals, right, is that the metals are not important as metals. They're only important as coolants, which means that they govern the thermal physics of the collapsing object. Right? It's all we're saying with the CMB is, hey, there's some other thermal influence, right? How do you get around it? Okay. I've said a lot about binary stars, but I haven't talked about the possible variations in binarity. It turns out you don't have to make extreme assumptions. And even if you do, the conclusion holds up. But we would like to know something about the binary properties. And in fact, in these cases, with these low metallicity stars, it's relatively straightforward to just go out and get radial velocity variations and look for orbits and find out about their binary properties. So, you know, this is yet another test case or boundary condition for theories of star formation.
So the S process ones, you need them to first be AGB stars and then blow up. Is that right?
They need to leave a compact unseen remnant.
Yeah. Okay, for the CEMP, yes. Yeah. So isn't it actually a little bit surprising that you still find them with companions? Because, I mean, what fraction of systems survive one of the members blowing up?
Oh, right. So those are consistent with 100% binarity, but only in a sort of technical sense. In other words, they haven't detected companions for all of them, but they've seen radial velocity variations consistent with 100% binarity. Now, there's still room for evolution in the system as you go along, for the binary to widen over time.
No, they're not blow up. These companions that he's talking about, the less massive basin.
Yeah, they're not supernova.
They won't go supernova.
No. Sorry, I misunderstood. Yes.
Will be left as a white dwarf.
Yeah, you were arguing for actual complete separation, right?
Well, yeah, I was wondering about unbinding the system.
Yeah, okay.
I mean, that question applies in a lesser form.
Yeah.
If you're going to remove order unity of the mass of the system,
yeah, exactly.
How many of them are going to
survive? Absolutely. So one of the really nicely detailed models for this HEO107 when it first came out was this binary model from Suda et al. And they went through this calculation and they said, well, given the conditions we need for the mass transfer and the subsequent evolution of the system, what should the period be now? And the answer is 150 years.
Okay, so it should only barely survive.
It should only barely survive, right, in that particular case. So a number of these are not going to survive, and in fact they're going to start contaminating the other half of the equation, right,
You'll see
CEMP, but you'll never see radial velocity variation. Some people, not thinking too carefully, are going to take that as evidence against this hypothesis, right? They're going to say, oh, you got carbon enhancement without a binary. But in fact, you're exactly right. You have to fold that in.
So, is there any mass transfer back so you would have X-rays?
That would occur over some fraction of the lifetime.
I mean, have you thought of looking at these things with Chandra or something?
I personally haven't, but maybe it should be done. I mean, that would be a fairly narrow time frame, right?
Sure.
Yeah.
Well, the one with the giants.
Yeah, that might be worth.
It would be, you know, it's in the time frame when if we're going to transfer mass, it would.
Right. Yeah. But it's pretty wide.
It's a pretty wide binary.
You'd be lucky.
Yeah.
You know, see the binary.
Yeah, that's a calculation that should. It's a feasibility calculation that should be done.
In these models that people do for transfer of carbon into the small star, do they then simply remove the carbon on top, or do they also calculate the amount of metal settling you have at the bottom?
The settling is very minor. The settling is in terms of
amazing sequence, right? Most of them.
Yeah. So in terms of upsetting the abundance pattern that you see, you've got a factor of 10,000 to deal with, right? So if the carbon only settles out and knocks you down by another half a dex, who cares? They're still way above this cutoff we use, and it doesn't matter. No, but the settling time for that much, and getting rid of all that carbon is really long. I don't think it's even possible. But some of the stellar atmosphere models do take this sort of thing into account, and so you can ask how wrong you can be. Yeah.
Okay, I see your globular cluster.
Yeah.
I was surprised globular clusters on your plot.
Yeah, so I didn't make this plot.
As far as I know, their IMFs are completely normal.
Yeah, so I'm actually...
In other words, the Milky Way at this point is way low.
I think that's low, yeah. So this is a preprint from Van Dockham from a couple weeks ago, I think. It was actually posted after I left New Haven to come here. So he's still soliciting comments, and I'll send him some, and you should feel free as well.
I think you're right. The Milky Way at this point is too low.
I think that one should be up here somewhere.
And so the same as the seven-linear galaxies and the
globular. Yeah, right. So some people would ask, well, why shouldn't this one be up here? Right.
If it's the same redshift.
It's not really. So the galaxies Peter's talking about, their formation epoch is more like 6. So it's over here. And, my rectangle should, actually, this side should just go this way.
Well, he doesn't know what it is.
No, he doesn't. But actually, the way he does this, he independently constrains both the formation epoch by assuming a single-age stellar population and the IMF.
He doesn't know between 2.5 and infinity. I mean, anything between 2.5 and infinity is impossible.
I'm not sure we're saying different things. You should look at it as, so all you're saying is the isochrones aren't good enough to distinguish two ages older than 10 billion years. Yeah, you should look at his plots, and because he does try this. He does try to independently constrain the formation epoch based on the Mariston model. So anyway, yeah, that's kind of a sideline. But yeah, so the thing about globular clusters is you think, oh, maybe they should all be up here. Well, I'm actually saying this stuff should probably shift over a little more. I'm not actually so sure about where this point comes from, even though I know the reference.
Global clusters are old, you know.
They're old, but you have this same problem with the ages,
No.
Yeah, well, okay.
You can the global cluster, you see the new stars, it's a huge...
No, what? Okay, but do you know redshift 4 versus redshift 6?
Oh, yeah, because there you can just get it to 1 giga a year.
Absolutely.
You know
where the
IMF
is. Yeah. It's a very narrow range. It's a different ballpark game compared to...
Okay. All right. So let's...
All the globular clusters are different before it changes.
So all I wanted to say about the globular clusters is they're completely different beasts, right? They form more or less on their own as a single-age population. They're not bound and co-spatial with a single dark matter halo. It's just hard to know how they fit into this overall picture of small pieces forming and coming together over time.
Yeah, they certainly fed the same background illumination as anything else. So
that's right.
But the problem is, if you put the Arches cluster.
Yeah.
If you count this MC as, how should I put it? As a temperature, you make this plot.
No, if you count if you make the temperature a redshift.
No, you make MC the temperature. Right?
No, why would you do that? Because you know the MC effectively, which is low. And you measure the temperature and you convert that into a redshift to put it onto this plot.
Okay,
right?
Okay.
And that ends up being.
Temperature's on top.
Yeah, there's a temperature. So you end up way over here and you end up down here. So this is the mystery, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So the question, obviously, is how you evade this warm black body surrounding you in some cases. Right?
Well, you don't evade. There's a missing parameter in your theory, which is the turbulent pressure. And, of course, it was larger than Augusta because our giant, we realized, the largest we ever had.
Okay, so how does that make the background temperature... irrelevant.
Well, no, your genes mass has two numbers in it.
Yeah.
And so in Larson's theory, this is a general problem in Larson's theory.
Yeah, right.
It's a beautiful theory, but the problem is, the characteristic density he wants to use is lower than the density of 99% of the star formation in the Milky Way.
99% of it?
Or not the vast majority of it, because the characteristic density in Larson's theory, where his IMF, so he has this curve of
temperature.
And the turnover, where he's computing his genes mass, is the density of about 10 to the minus 19.
No, it's 10 to the 6 per cubic centimeter.
So 10 to the minus
18.
18, okay. Yeah. That's, so 10 to the 6. A significant fraction of the star formation in the Milky Way occurs in regions where the mean density is 10 to the 6. Yeah.
So it's a characteristic that is relevant for the collapse of an individual star, but not for the fragmentation problem, in other words.
Yeah, I mean, it's a density that it's beautiful for Taurus, where the mean density is really low, and by the time you get to 10 to the 6, you're looking at something that's going to make an individual star.
Right.
But if you go look at the region where massive stars are formed.
So this is your view, is that this is the escape clause for the Arches cluster?
Possibly. It's a general problem.
I understand that. You explained this to me in Princeton a few months ago. And I think you're probably right.
This is a layer on the Arches cluster. Yeah. The density is much higher, and that drives the genes mass back down.
Yeah.
So maybe that's the way out.
Well, but you're saying it's more than just the mean density. It has something to do with it.
Well, it's density fluctuations, which is the consequence of turbulent pressure. So if you don't know what is the local level of turbulence, you cannot predict the critical mass because you have to consider both. Yeah. So he's thinking of mean density. I'm thinking even more about density fluctuation.
Yeah.
Why don't we have the last question from Tom?
Thank you. There is another intriguing observational result, I think, that sort of feeds into here, which is from DART. Where we look at all these nearby southern dwarfs for oil, look at the metallicity distribution function, we find nothing below minus 3.
Yeah.
And my feeling was that it's very difficult for your model to do that.
Why? You just delete the low mass stars by having that IMF be all massive stars. So the stars formed at minus 3.5 and below in those galaxies, but they didn't leave behind low-mass stars.
You still need it to form the minus 5 ones that you're talking about.
You need it to form the minus 5 ones in that object. You need some other object.
Right. But see, since they're very low mass, we're sort of saying, okay, you can't build the halo from these.
Yeah.
It's very enigmatic where the minus 4 form.
So I don't see a problem.
And the problem is that those which are left are late formers.
That's right.
Because those, precisely because they didn't build the halo. So the halo is not built out of those. Those are
Exactly. The part of the halo around us in the Milky Way has nothing to do with Draco.
Right, but you're arguing that still lower metallicity ones, less than the dwarf orbitals, so lower mass halos, then the dwarf orbitals would still have had lower metallicity. They would have produced the low metallicity stars like minus 4 and minus 5.
So it depends on the form.
Yeah. Oh, no, I see. You're right.
I'm thinking, small ones.
Yeah. No. If you want to make the same argument for both of these being early, then you run into a basic tension. Like I just said, you say, okay, the dwarf spherules don't form lots of extremely low metallicity stars, but hey, the halo progenitors did. My explanation for that is just I don't think that that's the explanation for the missing stars in the dwarf spherules. I think it's something else. It's not the IMF.
Actually, Jason, that's the wrong way, because they are late formers.
Yeah, that's...
So you would expect them to have low MC and actually have low metallicity, very low metallicity.
Right, no, but the other implication of them being late formers, the other thing that entails, is that they don't have their own first generation. They got it from somewhere else. And so the gas they accreted when they virialized was from the IGM, and it was already enriched. That's another implication of them being late formers. This was raised in the Helmy et al. Paper. This exact... Yeah, okay.
Okay, wait. I think we should go ahead and thank Jason.